Well, they say out of sight, out of mind, but sometimes even things right in front of us don't get the attention they need. Things like roads and bridges and railways and utility systems and more, really, are of vital importance to us as a nation. But a lot of that in a state of decay. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. We're going to be spending the next 40 minutes or so talking with Dan McNichol. He's a best-selling author, award-winning journalist, focusing especially on America's transportation infrastructure and engineering issues. He's currently touring the country in a vintage car on what he calls the Dire States Tour, and he's hoping to bring attention to the critical infrastructure issues facing us as a nation, and he'll be speaking on the UW-Madison campus on Monday. We'll tell you some more about that a little bit later. But in the meantime, Dan, great to have you on the program.
Larry, thank you for having me on your program.
I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. You've done a lot of writing about our infrastructure in this country. Maybe first, what do you include when you talk about infrastructure?
It's everything that you imagine connecting all of us together. It's if government is what we do together, infrastructure is what we build together. You might have your own infrastructure if you're a large manufacturing plant or you're a home or you're a facility like a hospital, but you tap into the grid that is everything. You know, there's the grid that carries electricity, yes, but there's also, if you look at the massive overall infrastructural grid, there's roads, there's bridges, there's heavy rail, there's light rail and transit, there are levees and waterways, there are schools and parks, and all of that adds up to 16 different categories of infrastructure that are highly interdependent and interconnected.
Yeah, and here we are, the American Society of Civil Engineers report card gives the U.S. infrastructure a grade of D+. Why?
Slightly up from a D. And if you think about it, I mean, the American Society of Civil Engineers, they've been around since 1852, 140,000 engineers. Their job they're to be the steward. They are the stewards of our infrastructure. They are culpable. They take an oath. They are responsible for making sure our infrastructure is as resilient and is as functional as possible. And their report card is a kind of a media play, but it's a way of saying, let's dummy this down, let's make it real simple, because you all have much more on your plate than our infrastructure issues. So here's our soundbite. We have a D+ in the country. But then if you dig in deeper to the report card, you'll see where they break it down by category. They even break it down by states.
Boy, and we should be worried about this.
Definitely. I mean, unless you're not worried about national security, unless you're not worried about the quality of your life or the income you bring in,
the economic impact has got to be huge.
I fell into this. I mean, I'm from a family of construction types, and I started learning more and more about the road systems. And it doesn't take too long in this country to come across Dwight Eisenhower, What I loved about Eisenhower is no one even knew if he was Republican or Democrat, and not even Truman,
yep,
supposedly. And then you find out that really his biggest achievement, he thought, domestically, was his interstate highway system. And not because he loved big trucks and big roads, but because he knew that commerce was going to be accelerated. He knew it would modernize America, and this interstate system did that. But it also gave us a lot of national security. It increased the quality of our lives. And that's simply what infrastructure does when it's done well, when it's done smartly. It improves the quality of life.
And of course, that road system, as a national, I guess we could consider that, as well as other parts of this, a national security issue.
Well, you know, Dwight Eisenhower said, along with every other president after him, our dependency on energy, on fossil fuels, is a problem for our national security. And he came down to the number of 20%. We shouldn't be expecting more than 20% to come in from overseas. Other than that, we're exposing ourselves. Well, that's true not only in the power or in oils, but it's true in all aspects of infrastructure. You need strong ports, because in peace they bring in goods, they allow us to ship out the goods that we manufacture. But when there's a deployment, it's called forts to ports, and there's a massive surge out of the forts right to the ports where they deploy the heavy gear and the heavy armory. And then it goes on and on. There's all these redundancies. And anybody that's in the military knows that anything you do for the peacetime efforts of an economy will strengthen the military-industrial complex.
Yeah. Dan McNichol, our guest today, best-selling author, award-winning journalist, currently touring the country in a vintage car. It's a 1949 Hudson. It's a matter of fact.
I'm calling her Mrs. Martin. She had one owner, and Mrs. Martin was her name. And Mrs. Martin evidently was a very strong woman, and she put it into a barn in 1956 because her husband was driving it too much. She swore no one would drive it again, and as long as she was alive, and that was the case. And I bought it on eBay in 2010, and I bought it, Larry, because it looks like, I think, America's infrastructure. It is beautiful. It is built well, but it's really old, it's rusty, and it's energy defunct. I hope to take you for a ride in it, Larry. I think you'd get it right away.
And that would be fun. That would be something fun to do. And when you're here, and you're speaking on Monday, as a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm most excited about this event. In the University of Wisconsin, which I grew up knowing all about and was excited about even as far away as Boston. And it's known. University has such a great reputation for political discourse. And I'm really excited about the idea of stirring it up and talking about this infrastructure crisis.
Yeah, we'll give some more details on that as we go along. But you can join in with your questions or comments as we visit with Dan McNichol. He has written a lot about our infrastructure, America's infrastructure and engineering issues. He'll be talking about that when he's at the UW-Madison campus in Engineering Hall on the campus on Monday. I think he's speaking at 3:30. We'll give you a little more on that as we move along. Actually, I have some information posted on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can just go there and get all the details as well as information about Dan and it's really some interesting stuff that he's dealing with. I want to take some calls. There are a lot of people who have questions for you. Bob in Richland Center up first. Bob, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning, Larry. Yeah, my question is for your guest is, how badly was Wisconsin hurt when the governor turned down the high-speed rail connection?
You may or may not know about that, Dan.
Bob, thanks for putting me on the third rail. I was talking about this years ago. I spent a lot of time in China, and I spent about a month every year over there. And I went there in 2003 for the first time, and I can't tell you how much that country is benefiting from its high-speed rail system. Entirely different animal, yes, in some cases, but no. China is exactly the same size as America. It's uncanny. Sometimes we're fourth, and sometimes they're fourth or fifth in the atlases in square miles. But the point being, this is an opinion, that we have a three-legged stool that we only have two legs of. We have a great highway system. We have a great aviation system, the best in the world in both cases. Our passenger rail has always been anemic, and it is a problem in the crowded Northeast, and I think Wisconsin was brave in even considering it. Should they build it? That's a really difficult question that I haven't gotten into the weeds on. But I think high-speed rail, anything that accelerates passenger rail service, anything that is more efficient and more fuel efficient than a car, which 99% of that is the weight of the vehicle that you're shipping, and you're the 1% that it's carrying, that's not a model that's going to be sustainable. And I love traveling from Boston to Washington on Amtrak, which I would call not so high speed, but it's still high speed. And you can imagine what that would be like going from Madison to Chicago or Madison down to out to Milwaukee or another point south like Indianapolis where I am right now.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Bob, for calling. Ron in Bradley, Illinois, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, sir. I lived in Kuwait for about 2 years, and the quality of their highways and all that has got us beat by comparison. I drive a truck, and I go across the country, and I'm in agreement with your guest there. Our infrastructure is just, our highways are beat up. It's almost to the point of, if I was a foreigner and I came to America, I wouldn't believe it. Yeah. I mean, that's how pessimistic I am about it. We take the metro train into the city of Chicago all the time, and the metro station in the city is just so out of date. The bathrooms are tore up. It's just the neglect. And the money that we have in our economy, I just can't believe that our country is falling apart like that. It's just unbelievable.
Thank you very much for calling, Ron. And Dan, comment?
Ron, I feel your pain. And in Wisconsin, you feel it even more than the country does. 71% of your roads are really in poor, mediocre condition. And nationally, that number is not quite, but almost half. And I'm in Indiana, where 10% of the roads are in that condition. It varies widely. And I don't know, Professor, know why Wisconsin's roads are in rough shape. But it deters commerce. It makes the road that much less safe. And when you think about the investment, I was talking to the engineer in charge of all of New York City. You know, if they put in $150 million to bridges that are resout, that's all they'll need. But they find themselves putting in $400 million a year because they've been left to deteriorate. So that hole in your roof, for example, is now leaking water that is causing all sorts of damage structurally. If you just patch the hole, you'd be better off. Same case on roads. It's almost the same case across the board in all infrastructure.
Well, and Ron mentioned another country. How do we compare to other countries in the priority we give to our infrastructure? You mentioned China as well. What kind of resources are we devoting to it compared to others?
Well, we have dropped steadily and quickly in the worldwide infrastructural categories. And our total ranking has dropped from 6 to something like 26. And that's been in the last 5-10 years. You could watch our ranking fall. And that matters even more so, as you can imagine, because of the global economy we now find ourselves in. And where China is investing in their infrastructure because they have to catch up. But to our other side is Europe, and they're acting like one country, the United States of Europe. And those European countries are improving their infrastructure. They have a whole different culture about maintaining their infrastructure. And we're now competing with less. And it feels like I'm driving across the country in a 49 Hudson when I think about what we are doing with our ports, what we're doing with our airports, what we're doing across the board. We're using very old, broken-down facilities, and we're trying to compete in a game that we're not well suited for at this point.
Yeah. Mike in Milwaukee, hi, thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry, how you doing?
Good.
All right, my comment is basically, I've come to think of it as, it's kind of a joke to me now. I call America the richest third world country in the world because everywhere I look, I see falling down buildings, roads that are falling apart, and the only people that have the money to fix it are the people that just don't care. They don't have to deal with them on a regular basis, so, you know, their world is somewhere else, and our world is here, unfortunately.
Yeah. Dan?
Well, I'd like to source that, the richest third world country in the world. I just wrote a piece about investing in our infrastructure, and Canada invests about 25% of its infrastructure money privately. We do about 1% of that right now. Yeah. And there's an enormous amount of resources on the sidelines waiting to jump in. And I think we're the largest emerging market for these models called P3. And they've had some bad names and good names. But what I'm finding is the people who put out these ideas about public and private partnerships, the states that took off were Virginia, Texas, and Florida. The states that were laggards have now joined them, and they are now right behind them. The laggards were Massachusetts, New York, and Pennsylvania. And those are old Rust Belt states that are now seeing the only way to get people to work in their trades is to start getting some private money into the game. So maybe that'll change, but I couldn't agree more. We have systems that make us look like third world. I've even heard people joke about, well, in Germany, we bring our children to the United States so they understand what Germany looked like 10 years, 20 years after World War II, so they understand what Germany has come from.
Man. Dan McNichol, our guest today, a best-selling author, currently touring the country in a vintage car in what he calls the Dire States Tour. He'll be speaking on the UW-Madison campus in the College of Engineering on Monday at 3:30 in Engineering Hall. Be lecturing there and also a panel and joining a panel discussion with our DOT secretary and Community Environmental Engineering Department Chair and UW Director of Sustainability, Craig Benson, at 4:30 as well. Great topic, and I'm certainly inviting you to join in with your own questions or comments. You can weigh in, too, at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, though, we're going to hear about some more about our infrastructure from Dan McNichol. And what do you think? I mean, what's your opinion of our infrastructure? Something you worry about? Are there local concerns for you? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Dan, are there some visionary thinkers out there who you think we would benefit from listening to on this issue?
You know, I look at the outgoing mayor of New York City. Michael Bloomberg has done so much for that city and try to broadcast what he's doing there across the country as a cure for some of these problems that we're talking about. But he's not only a remarkable businessman and turned out to be a successful mayor, but he was trained as a civil engineer. And he you can tell by his policies that he thinks structurally, he thinks analytically. And we're on the anniversary to the day almost of Hurricane Sandy. And when a storm the size, you know, a superstorm the size of the state of Texas rolled into the Hudson Bay, it breached almost every of the 16 categories. The water and the surge went over the levees. The water went rushing into the mass transit systems. It fried the electrical systems. It blacked out the city. It shut down airports. It did everything you'd imagine a storm would do, but it became a great model of what happens when systems fail. And he came back less than a year later and said, here's a program. Here's $20 billion to build not only gray infrastructure like concrete and steel, but green infrastructure like oyster beds. And it's this culmination and his open-mindedness to looking at all possibilities in his proposal. And I think he knows that it's not going to come out the way he's proposed it, but he's putting forward an idea. He's saying this is what the city needs to do. If the cities that understand this, like in the Netherlands, if they are protecting themselves the way they do with hard lines and green infrastructure as well, we need to do the same. We're exposed. We're incredibly vulnerable, and it's going to cost even more next time that this happens.
Ron in Abrams, Wisconsin, appreciate your call. Hello.
Yes, sir. What gets me is they keep building the big infrastructures. I'm sure he's going to see the one in Green Bay that they've been building on for years and will be building on yet for years. And like you said, you can't take care of what you got. To me, it's a waste of money. If you're building something that you can't pay for or take care of, why build it? It's like somebody buying a new car and not taking care of it and not changing oil and so on and so forth. They aren't going to have the money with cars getting more gas mileage and so on and so forth. They got less money coming in. And then again, why don't the Koch brothers put their money into something worthwhile instead of giving it all to people to get reelected? Put it into our infrastructure and help everybody out.
Well, I think you're also saying, Ron, sort of we should be spending some money on maintaining our current ones, it sounds like you're saying, as opposed to a lot of new. But, Dan, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's true. If why build it if you're not going to maintain it? And you look at some systems that are needed, and they are maintained, and other systems become abandoned. The interstate highway system is maintained because we are so dependent upon it. The interstate highway system is one of those grand plans that came out of post-World War II America. I think we've come to think that projects have to be magnificent, and I've been guilty of this. I'm drawn to the mega projects because they pull you in. They're so dynamic. They're so overwhelming. That's what is inspiring about them. But they don't, you know, some of the smartest infrastructure we need is the dumbest infrastructure. We need pipes. Our water systems are so broken down, and we're looked at as one of the only places on the earth that you'd stick your mouth underneath the faucet and drink from it. But at the same time, our systems are 100 years old. We are the first ones out with it, and we're still using them.
Yeah.
Sometimes they look like logs in the middle of the street when they dig up utility lines. So, yes, I agree. The culture of maintenance needs to come this way. It's in Europe now, and it needs to come this way. And products don't need to be grand. They just need to be smart, and sustainability is all about that.
Thanks, Ron. Jack in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Very interesting topic.
Thank you.
I'd like you to separate between the idea of reinvigorating our infrastructure, and I'm thinking sort of specifically buildings and the such. I'm from Milwaukee, and I think part of the allure of the city is the old industrial complex that used to be here and is now mostly abandoned. But, you know, I would hate to see that leave and be replaced by high-rise condos made out of drywall.
Here, here. I mean, I live in a loft in Boston. It's an old leather factory. And I look at these cities that are wanting to build new, say, like Shanghai. But really, what drives the new growth often are these old sections. And people love to go into the French Quarter in Shanghai. And, you know, it's both. You need both. You need places to open up and grow big, and you need to preserve those gems, because that's what makes a city so exciting. That's where the energy is often, in these older areas and these areas that show the history and the layers of infrastructure. But I couldn't agree more. If you know, cities are back. Cities are where people want to be, and this is why we need to preserve the city as much as we need to rebuild it.
Roger in Deer Park, Illinois. Hi, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I was on that Illinois tollway a few months ago coming toward Chicago, and it was appalling. They had those cement embankments so close together, no safety lane. You could reach out the window and touch them. That's how close they were. And then you get a big truck next to you, which you could reach out the window and touch. Very scary. So my question is, why do they take so long to repair these highways? You see just empty lanes for miles and miles, no one working. Why can't they get several contractors there and get these things done more quickly like they do in Canada? And why is this safety such a problem? I consider myself an excellent driver, and I was scared. And I haven't been on the tollway since. How they could put a situation like, it was foggy that day too, put a situation like that, no shoulder, And have you so packed in there, and you get next to those semi trucks, and it's pretty scary.
Yeah. Comment, Dan?
Well, I know that fear, especially in an old car. Like,
yeah.
When you have half the voltage and half the horsepower you need, and you're always looking for a breakdown lane, when they take them away, it's just frightening. Work is going on 24/7 on roads now, though, and I don't know this issue on the in the Illinois toll road, but what I have experienced, what I have seen personally that infuriates me, is when you have a long, long, 7 mile long construction site, and there are just a small handful of people working. It seems unnecessary. But if you look at what's going on, it's called business continuation, and they cannot shut down roads now like they used to be able to at night. People weren't around, or they would take out a lane because the capacity wasn't so high during the day. That wouldn't be a problem. There's so much activity, a lot of it being trucking, as you pointed out, and they can't shut the road down during the day, not even negotiable. And then they do it at night. And when they do it at night, it becomes a dangerous work zone, and that creates hazards of its own kind. But we're finding less and less downtime for the system to actually do the work on it.
Yeah.
And that's part of the challenge. Yeah. The tightness in the barriers and the danger at hand. I've talked to workers who have worked behind cones without the barriers, and they say they're much more exposed, obviously, than they ever want to be, because when you just have a small orange cone to protect you from a car, they don't feel safe. So when they put the jersey barriers in there to do the work, it often creates a tightness that's not comfortable for anybody.
Yeah. Thanks, Roger. Kyle in Madison, hello to you.
Hello.
I'm mostly calling just to comment on the fact that we have these beautification projects as part of it. I've seen in a number of cities on the West Coast where they spend multi-millions of dollars creating a median with flowers. I see it in Madison where they create these kind of little traffic islands at the intersection, which make it more dangerous, and there's squanderance of dollars when there's so much more that, you know, important potholes that need to be fixed. And then also, we're the only developed country, if I'm not mistaken, and this is more of a question, how many other first world countries spend, not even spend, hemorrhage as a large amount of money on their military industrialization zones and companies and the complex or whatever we would call it, and give zero, and, you know, don't tax the corporations that actually use these highways and roadways, as well as the citizenry. The highways are also huge transporters of goods, as well as the people that manufacture those goods or procure them in the office, and they have to get to work, and those corporations aren't paying their share.
Dan?
Well, I'm not sure. What's the question?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's a priority where maybe our priorities are mixed up. We're spending money on military versus infrastructure.
Well, you know, this is where I find going back to Eisenhower is fascinating. You know, in his purest form, I mean, his mother was almost a conscientious objector during the Second World War. He came from an Amish background of sort. He was Mennonite, I believe, but no one's even too sure where he was politically or religiously. But he didn't believe in organized religion, and my point is he came from grassroots. He didn't have a big agenda. He was not corporate. He built roads and did it earnestly in the military because he felt like, and he saw from his role models, General Fox Connor and General Pershing from the World War I fame, that anything you do that bolsters the economy, and a road at that time especially was the prime example, will help the economy grow, will flatten out the inequalities in society, and it will drive home the needs when they become real for the military. And that's why I think he saw the interstate highway system, which the full name is the Dwight D. Eisenhower System of Interstate and Defensive Highways. That is the full name of the interstate system.
Wow.
And that's, I think, so powerful because, you know, he built up military industrial complexes to get us through World War I and get us through World War II, and then he warned us against them when he was leaving. But I think he understood them, if nothing else. He created them, and he was warning us against them, but he knew that in, you know, peacetime money well spent would allow us to pursue our happiness, which is part of our fiber and our DNA in this country.
Yeah. You advocate that we build, I think you said, smarter, faster, and better. Maybe break that down. What do you mean by smarter and faster and better?
Well, I don't think you can build smart unless you're building fast. When you're talking about precious resources like dollars, you know, if you squander them, then You're wasting not only dollars, but you're wasting a lot of opportunities for schools or somebody else to pick up the mantle. The smarter, faster, and better. You know, we have to pick our and choose our battles. We only have so many dollars to pursue so many cures infrastructurally. So, which projects matter the most? And that varies from Hawaii to Alaska to Wisconsin. They're all going to be different, but it's a very local issue. And then once you decide, you must move quickly, and that means avoid litigation. You know, if environmentally this is what we're required to do, don't take it to court. Pony up, do the right thing, and move through the environmental process quickly. At the same time, environmentalists have to realize that these systems are needed, and they can't hold up these projects because it's going to cost the public and the taxpayers badly. And when I think sustainable, I think anything that preserves our natural resources and lessens our footprint on the earth is so important. We lose 7 billion gallons of clean water every day that we drive into the earth. That water's been purified, that water's been pumped, that water's been moved, a lot of coal's been burned to move that water, and we let that water travel through leaky pipes. That's not sustainable. So all those things together, you know, pick your battle, build it quickly, build it smartly, And then most of all, I think if we can build systems that focus on the sustainability aspects, we're really moving.
Oh, I love your idea of the Dire Straits tour. How has that been going? Give us a little background on it.
Well, the Golden Gate Bridge and the Bay Bridge. I was out in San Francisco for a couple of years working on the narrative for the new San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. It was a wonderful commission from the state of California. But what got me thinking out there was the states used to take such responsibility, and we've kind of become addicted to federal funding. And the states are in dire condition, and the infrastructure in those states is in dire condition. And the Dire Straits just came up in a brainstorming session, and I thought, that is it. That speaks it perfectly. The states are now feeling what it was like in the 1930s, I believe. The states are starting to feel like their sovereignty matters. They have these abilities and they have these powers. Now they got to step up and use them again because the federal monies are drying up. States are now more responsible than ever for their infrastructure and their own programming. And that's true at the local level. That's trickled down. And the Golden Gate Bridge was built with a $35 million loan from the Bank of America to six counties, including San Francisco. It was a real estate play. It played out beautifully. But that's because six counties took it upon themselves to take on an infrastructure project that has changed their lives even five generations later.
Yeah, and only $35 million. It was probably a lot at the time.
But they had a meter on there. They had a toll, and they were able to, that's sustainable in another form, financially sustainable. They were able to become a very wealthy highway district, and they actually started building ferry systems and ports for a ferry and a bus service as well. I mean, they were able to grow that success and that private investment into a very profitable corporation.
Yeah. Well, what kind of reaction are you getting as you drive across the country in your Hudson?
I get everything from police officers stepping out. I think I'm going to get pulled over, and they're like, I love that car. Or, what year is that? And you know what's so wonderful about this old car, Larry, is that people just disarm, and it makes the conversation approachable. Everyone's got an opinion, and everyone's welcome to it. I'm out there trying to find out what it is. I'm a little too close to the subject, so I felt it was important to get away from it. And this old car really helps in just keeping it simple and having a laugh along the way.
Yeah. We got a Facebook comment from Timothy who said, I want to say hello to Dan because I, too, am a Hudson owner, and I have really enjoyed his articles in the White Triangle News. We have a 54 Hornet Hollywood hardtop. Welcome to Madison, Dan.
Well, that's awesome. I'd love to see him on campus because the old girl, Mrs. Martin, is going to be parked in the middle of the campus. And Larry, I'm telling you, I feel like I'm method acting. I feel like I am broken infrastructure when I'm in this car. I honk the horn and the lights dim. I accelerate up a hill and the wipers they slow down or stop. It's just, but that's kind of what our water systems are like. That's kind of what our schoolhouses look like.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Oh, man. Well, what are you going to – you're speaking on Monday evening on the UW-Madison campus, Monday afternoon, actually. What are you going to cover there?
Well, this is the most challenging audience I'm imagining, students. It's a little frightful going in there because they have fresh minds. They're wide open, and I hope they have strong opinions and they shout them out. And what I'd like to do, if they'll let me, is just – say, okay, a lot of people in the industry of coal construction are unaware of how all these different categories, these 16 categories, connect. Let me just explain to you what they are, how magnificent our systems are, and how vulnerable they are as well. And then I hope to break it up into a discourse. I want to know what these bright minds want, what they're gaming for, because the infrastructure we build today is their infrastructure. It's such a long game that anything we build now has to have a 50, 60, maybe 100-year life. And that means it's their infrastructure and their children's infrastructure.
Yeah. And you're speaking at 3:30 on the UW-Madison campus in Engineering Hall. And then following that, you've got a panel discussion with our DOT, Department of Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb, and Civil Engineering Department Chair and Director of Sustainability Craig Benson at 4:30, and then there's a host reception at I think around 5:15 or so. So you're going to be a busy guy.
And I hope there's some beer, some good local beer at the end of all that.
You can rest assured that there will be, you know, Wisconsin is known now for its craft beers. I think we have something like 70 craft breweries in the state. And my guess is you're probably going to see something like Spotted Cow. That's a beer.
I love that name.
Yeah, Spotted Cow and maybe, well, I'm not sure. Hopalicious, maybe you'll see.
Hopalicious in the Hudson. Well, you know, of course, without keys, without the thing moving. But, you know, on the hood, the, and you know what? What I've heard, too, is, not to get off the subject, but biking around Madison. I want to bike the next day and bike around Madison because I saw this huge piece of bridge work that went over the highway there, and I thought, man, they take it seriously. They get it.
We've got lots of bike trails, and you can bike around our lakes and through our communities and in the city, and you're going to have a really good time. Anything, just as we end here. What's your message to our listeners? Anything we can do? What can we do?
Well, thanks for asking, Larry. That's always the toughest call because this subject's about everything. Infrastructure's about everything. I would just say, give a damn about it. That's DAM about your infrastructure. You know, find out what is ailing your town. You probably already know, and then figure out like what is the solution. What is a possible cure. And then find the leadership, and what that looks like, it could be anything. It could be a DPW chief, a Department of Public Works chief. It could be you. It could be your mayor or selectman or whatever. And then figure out how to fix it. Like, hold the leaders accountable, but inform them and work with them. Don't blame them or don't just ask them to do something or gripe, but get involved with the solution. And I think it becomes a really powerful experience.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you this coming week, Dan. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Larry, I can't thank you enough. It's been real exciting. And can I just say one shout-out? In Black
Sure.
River Falls, there's a dam. The town, 3,000 people, took it on to raise $10 million to rebuild that dam. A professor named Daniel Mead designed it in 1911. He was at the University of Wisconsin. Mead and Hunt redesigned the bridge, the dam, just a couple years ago, last year. And it is a perfect example of a town taking back their infrastructure, that dam's producing energy at a low trickle rate of the river or a mad torrent. And it's a wonderful project, a wonderful example of what you just suggested. Like, what can we do? Look at Black River Falls Dam Project and the people up there and what they've done. They've done a remarkable job.
Oh, thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate you spending time with us today.
Thank you, Larry.
Great pleasure. Author and infrastructure expert Dan McNichol. As I mentioned, he's traveling the country in a rusty 1949 Hudson car to start a conversation about our aging transportation infrastructure on what he calls the Dire States Tour. During his stop at UW-Madison, he's going to be giving a free lecture. It's open to the public, open to you and me. Lectures at 3:30. And then he'll be joining a panel discussion, which is also open to the public, of course. Mark Gottlieb and Professor Craig Benson will be part of that panel discussion, then a reception following it. But it's Monday, this coming Monday at 3:30 to begin with, an engineering hall on the UW-Madison campus. And he's a really, as you listen, I'm sure you realize he's a really engaging guy. And I know his talk's going to be really a lot of fun.